as well as Chief describes as humiliating downfall Donald Trump's failure in the U.S. presidential election, calling his administration among the worst in U.S. history. The United Nations once again voices concern about the worsening humanitarian situation in Yemen, saying the millions of people in the war-torn country are facing famine. And Iran's ambassador to the IAEA has called on the UN nuclear watchdog to refrain from making hasty comments about the country's nuclear program. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story is Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, says he is pleased with the U.S. President Donald Trump's humiliating defeat.
On the emotional level, no one can stop us from feeling happy. It is our right. For this humiliating downfall by his own people brought him down because he humiliated them too, and he humiliated his allies and his friends and carried out attacks against the people of the world.
Said Hassan Nasrallah, however, said that Trump's move to dismiss the U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper could be a prelude to more dangerous decisions in the remaining 2 months of his administration. Nasrallah described Trump as the worst ever American president, adding that he revealed the true face of the arrogant U.S. policies which put the entire world on the brink of war. Elsewhere in his remarks, the Hezbollah Secretary General said the U.S. poses as the world model for democracy while facing social and political problems itself. He noted the disputed presidential election revealed the realities in the U.S. Political commentator Eric Wahlberg says a lame duck Donald Trump could be dangerous to the world.
I think that Nasrallah, it's wonderful when we're all on the same page. The good guys are, and we have even Biden and part of America now really moving away from that outrageous and very dangerous policies of Trump and bullying the rest of the world. I think that all of us will be glad to see an end to that. I think I've been checking the news on the election and the claims of fraud, and there really is no basis, and not even Republicans are beginning to desert him. So that's not really my worry so much as the havoc that he will still be able to. He's got 2 months left before he hands over the reins of power to Biden on January 20th. So that's a long time in Trump terms, because he's now lame duck. Well, he should be a lame duck, but he's not. He's fighting and trying to leave some kind of weird legacy. It's as if he wants to be remembered as the most reviled and despised American president. I don't know. Maybe he's such a psychopath he doesn't even understand. I think that's it. He doesn't really understand where he is now.
And political tensions continue to mount in the U.S. as President Donald Trump refuses to concede to Joe Biden, who's been projected as the presidential election winner. So while Biden prepares to assume office and has even set up a coronavirus task force, Trump is crying election fraud and filing multiple lawsuits. Earlier, we discussed this issue in our news review program, and here it is. The row over the recently held presidential election in the U.S. continues amid harsh rhetoric over the vote outcome, which gives a Democratic candidate Joe Biden a clean sweep. Speaking to Fox News on Tuesday, White House press secretary claimed they'd be holding more than 200 pages of affidavits proving voter fraud. Callie McEnany said the fraud includes dead people voting as well as casting their ballots, some people casting ballots multiple times. Meanwhile, U.S. media, citing bipartisan officials from dozens of states, said there is no substantial evidence of fraud or other irregularities. Media outlets have projected Biden a clear winner of the race, but incumbent President Donald Trump has yet to concede. On Wednesday, the state of Georgia said it will recount ballots due to a slim margin between Biden and Trump there.
With the margin being so close, it will require a full by-hand recount in each county. This will help build confidence. It will be an audit, a recount, and a re-canvass all at once.
Georgia's Secretary of State said that Biden leads Trump by just over 14,000 votes out of some 5 million across the state. Trump campaign says it also plans to request a recount in Wisconsin, where Biden leads by 20,000 votes. Meanwhile, Delaware has become the first state to finalize its results, with Biden taking around 60% of the vote in his home state. Five other states have followed suit. States have until the 8th of December to certify their results. The Electoral College will meet 6 days later to make the results official. Joining us now for this news review is Colin Campbell from Washington, D.C., and Daniel Lazare, journalist and author, joining us from New York. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Colin, hope you're doing well. We'll start with you. Give us the latest if you can, please.
Well, right now we're still in a holding pattern as the president-elect is preparing for his transition and is trying to get together all the information that he can to take on COVID-19, which seems to be his top priority at the moment, one of those first 100 days issues that he plans to address. And he's looked at various people for his cabinet. Of course, this is not even close to a done deal, but he's been shopping around. One of the people that has been discussed as the Secretary of Labor would be a former rival, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. And that would be a unifying type of move if he were to ask Sanders to be as part of his cabinet, as we know that the more progressive parts of our population really wanted to see a Bernie Sanders presidency. But of course, that didn't happen. And I think they would be more amenable to at least having him as part of the cabinet. Meanwhile, it seems that more foreign leaders have congratulated President-elect Biden on his win more than actual Republican senators. And I think that many of them are holding out to see just where these lawsuits that are filed on behalf of the president and his administration will go. He has until December, approximately. That's when the votes will be certified through the Electoral College, and then they will vote. And once that vote goes in, then that person will be officially president. And president-elect and then president that to be inaugurated the following year. Some have theorized the president will ride this all the way out until Christmas and then slowly disappear. Who knows what the president will do? Right now, we just know that he is fighting this as much as possible, even though there are no indications that a new vote count, a recount, will reverse any of the election results.
Thank you, Colin. And Daniel, I'd like to welcome you to the program here. Now, it's funny, Colin said, who knows what the president will do. But guess what? A lot of people actually care what Donald Trump is doing and that he's not getting involved with the transition right now. A lot of people feel it's really bad for the country. Your thoughts on what's going on?
Well, I mean, I've been arguing for 25 years that America was heading into a severe constitutional crisis. Its constitution is 230 years old. It's essentially unchangeable. It's completely and totally out of date. It has no relevance at all to the needs of a modern 21st century society. And now we've been seeing it breaking down more and more, and this seems to be the ultimate breakdown, where an election is ending in it's ending in rancor, in an argument, in dispute, and there are even rumors of a coup d'etat or something approaching that. Trump has fired top Pentagon officials and replaced them with his own loyalists. There are rumors that he may fire the head of the FBI and the CIA and replace them with loyalists as well. So America is really heading into uncharted territory. The turbulence will likely increase over the coming weeks. And we have no idea where we'll end up, but there's every reason to think that we will see more turmoil, more breakdown, more chaos.
And do you think he's stocking up on loyalists, Daniel, to try to sabotage Biden's possible presidency or to basically try to use them as a tool to keep himself in power?
No one knows, but the second possibility cannot be dismissed. I mean, he's filling the Pentagon. The rumors are he'll do the same thing to the CIA and FBI with loyalists, and that suggests strongly that he wants to have those power centers on his side if when push comes to shove and there's a real showdown as to who takes power on January 20th.
Gentlemen, thank you both. Stay safe till we speak to both of you again. Always a pleasure to get your perspectives. Colin Campbell there joining us from Washington, D.C., and Daniel Lazare there joining us out of New York. That's a wrap for the segment of your news review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. The U.N. has warned of a looming catastrophe in Yemen as the country is grappling with years of destructive Saudi war.
We're on a countdown right now to a catastrophe in Yemen. The people, they've been ravaged by years of conflict-fueled hunger, malnutrition. Now there's a toxic combination taking place of surging violence, as Martin was talking about, and Mark referenced a deepening of the economic and currency collapse that Mark just referred to, and COVID-19 is ratcheting up the misery to a whole new level.
The UN official further said that the world must realize the unfolding humanitarian disaster in Yemen before it's too late. And David Beasley added that Yemen will be plunged into a devastating famine affecting millions of people within a few short months. UN has called for aid operations as the most efficient way to support famine prevention efforts. Saudi Arabia launched war on Yemen back in early 2015 and has so far killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, most of them civilians. UN has described the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. And now joining us out of Westchester for more on the story is Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer from Westchester University. Your thoughts on the UN time and again, that given this thing that, hey, they're just months away from famine or cholera or diphtheria or some, you know, atrocity is afflicting the people of Yemen, but nothing ever changes. Your thoughts on this latest report by the UN inspectors or specialists?
Well, they're no doubt accurate. I think that it's unfortunate, but the world, if you will, is distracted by their own pandemic. And the United States, which is a normal source of charitable disposable income, isn't ready to contribute. In fact, Trump's policy is to make things worse. We can hope that after January 20th, Biden shows some charitable generosity towards Yemen through the UN. I know he's going to reapproach the UN and try to solidify U.S. membership to the extent that Trump has weakened it. But I think that, you know, ultimately, there's also a sense that this thing is never ending, that there's no, you know, it's just one cliffhanger after another. And so even if the rest of the world kind of is able to refocus its attention here, you're going to get donor fatigue and that kind of thing. And so it might be suggestive things might crack a little if the International Criminal Court brought the Saudi prince prosecuted him for war crimes or something like that. This seems certainly to warrant that kind of a move.
Right. Larry, what about a Biden presidency? Because we know there is growing opposition to what's going on in Yemen and the fact that Washington supports it. Do you think with the Biden presidency, we may see an about-face on Yemen policy?
Well, I don't know if it's going to be about face, but I know that there are people who are going to try to get him to back away from Saudi Arabia to the extent that they will no longer support Saudi efforts or Gulf nation efforts in this war. So the withdrawal of naval support and this sort of thing. They will continue to sell arms to Saudi Arabia because there's an enormous lobby in Washington, devoted to selling weapons to Saudi Arabia that they never really need because it's so lucrative. But there is a chance of backing away from naval support, or which would allow a potential breaking of the boycott keeping material aid out of Yemen.
Good stuff, bud. Always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for joining us out of Westchester. That's Lawrence Davidson there, former lecturer from Westchester University. You bet. Iran's ambassador to the UN has urged transparency in Saudi Arabia and Israel's nuclear programs. In a speech to the UN General Assembly, Majid Takht-Ravanchi stressed that if Riyadh seeks to pursue a peaceful nuclear program, then it needs to grant the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors access to its sites. The Iranian diplomat also noted that Israel is not yet party to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and has so far rejected inspection of its nuclear activities. Takht-Ravanchi said over the past 22 years, 22% of IAEA inspections were carried out in Iran, and that even the coronavirus pandemic has not stopped agencies' activities in the country. He also condemned U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and Washington's violation of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231. And the Iranian ambassador to the IAEA has urged the U.N. nuclear watchdog to refrain from making hasty comments about the country's nuclear program. Kazem Karimabadi said Iran is involved in interactions with the IAEA despite technical differences with the agency. He made the remarks after the body claimed Iran has not provided a technically credible response to the presence of uranium particles at what it called an undeclared nuclear site. The IAEA added that it continues to verify the non-diversion of nuclear material declared by Iran under its safeguards agreement. Vienna correspondent Homolezgi says that the IAEA's report on Iran's low-enriched uranium stockpile is what Tehran had announced to do before.
The Iranian envoy to the IAEA has said that indeed the report does include this information that Iran's stockpile of low-enriched uranium has been increasing. There's not been any change in that, basically, since Iran's announcement that it is going to increase its stockpile beyond the limit set in the JCPOA, not just the amount, but also the level of purity. So it's enriching uranium up to 4.5% rather than the 3.67% that was the limit set in the JCPOA or the nuclear deal. That is, of course, how Iran was responding to the fact that U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the JCPOA in May of 2018, and the Europeans were not able to give Iran the economic incentives that were enshrined in the deal. But Iran has also made it clear that these measures are all reversible, that if the United States does come back to the deal, and if the Europeans also give Iran the economic benefits that are part of that deal, then it can reverse these actions and it will go back to the limits set in the deal.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. Amir Kabir. Khayyam. Maulana. Avicenna. Khwarizmi. Iranian notables, sources of global honor.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in this episode, you will get familiar with the Iranian poet who lived in 7th and 8th centuries AH, corresponding to 13th and 14th centuries AD. He was Seyf Faraghani. Seyf Faraghani has been known as a leader of socio-political poetry in Farsi language. The 7th and 8th centuries AH were among the bright eras of Iran's literary history, as masters of poetry and Gnosticism like Maulana, Sa'di, and Hafez lived in that era. We said there is little known about the life and times of Saifuddin Abul Mahomed Muhammad Faraghani. Dr. Zabiullah Safa, who has edited his divan or collection of poems, writes in the introduction, "Our whole information about him is restricted to the divan of poems that has remained for us. As there is name or trace mentioned in the literary references and sources of this able poet, although he had a high status in expression of mystic concepts and, certainly, has been one of the leaders of Khanqah, there is no trace of him in the Farsi books of the great figures of mysticism and Gnosticism." You heard that Saifuddin Mohammed Muhammad Faraghani was born in Transoxiana and left his town Farghane for Asia Minor, current Turkey, in youth. He lived the rest of his life in Aksaray, a small town of the region. This episode will be mostly dedicated to explanation of the era of Mongol onslaught. The Mongol onslaught that had been started by Genghis Khan ended by Temur's rule in Iran. The era of his rule was very tumultuous and resulted in widespread devastation of the Iranian plateau. Although this period was very destructive and bloody for Iran, the men of letters and poets did their best in safeguarding the injured culture and literature amid all disasters. Iran was a subordinate of the Mongol Empire in those days. Even after the end of Mongol era, Iran was ruled by his grandchildren. However, after the termination of their rule, a few kings and rulers came to power in Iran who were weak and incompetent. Thus, the ground was set for Tamerlane's dominance over the country. Historical books have given the details of Genghis Khan's massacres and crimes in detail. In the book of Jahangoshay Joveni, we read, "After the arrival of Genghis troops in the city of Marv, they started looting, raping, and shedding the blood of innocent people. They continued their crimes for 4 years. They separated women from men, captivated 400 men in various professions, and girls and boys, and killed the rest of the people. The book makes it clear that each of the Mongol soldiers killed over 300 people of Marv. It is said that more than 1.3 million people were massacred. The cruel massacre of people by Mongols swept across all cities and villages that they assaulted. Many simple-minded people believed that Genghis Khan was the scourge of God. Genghis Khan himself also believed that he was the scourge of God unto the sinners. After capturing the city of Bukhara, the rich and merchants of the city were brought to him. He told them, "O people, you should know that you have committed big sins. I am God's punishment. Had you not committed big sins, God would have not sent me to punish you." Unfortunately, most of the attacks of the Mongols would face little resistance, as the rulers and kings were not popular and mostly thought of their throne rather than the lives of people. For example, the forces of Muhammad Khwarazm Shah fled the city of Balkh after just 3 days of fighting. The result of the Mongol invasion was a very weak rule and a decadent society. The whole social and economic structure was destroyed, and corruption was rampant everywhere. There was no order in the social system of the country, and an inexperienced group of rulers and ministers took the helm of power. Most of these people maintained that the only way of salvation and prosperity was absolute obeisance to the Mongols. Therefore, Mongol beliefs and traditions such as superstition and a belief in vicious ghosts and sorcery prevailed everywhere. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion. Till then, God bless.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. وبه نستعين إنه خير ناصر ومعين. To talk about how could we live in this world, there are many, many issues would be covered, but for me, some of them are so important, and I've chosen one because it is crucial and plays the role of engine for moving forward. And that's change happening in this world and our life. What is the meaning of change? How could we actualize the potential change in our life? What is the way for channelizing the change to be beneficial for ourselves? What does Quran say? What does Islam say in this regard? Is there any way prescribed by the Holy Quran to change or not? These are some issues I wanted to start with, and inshallah to go through that topic and reach some points. I don't want to take your time more, but the issue would be covered here is the most important issue that is always coming to a question, and it is under question all the time, and people from different expertise are interested in this issue. And some people, when they try to change themselves, they focus on the past or they focus on the future. But you know, all the time we think about whatever we did and that was so bad, and we cannot change because it is out of our, you know, out of our hand. We cannot control the past. It is past. And the future is not coming yet. How could we change the future or change the past? Then cannot be successful in the process of changing. What Amir al-Mu'mineen says, this is attributed, this poem to Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he says, مَا فَاتَ مَضَى وَمَا سَيَأْتِيكَ فَأَيْنَ. What past is past. There is no past now. It is nothing. وَمَا سَيَأْتِيكَ فَأَيْنَ. And what will come is not coming yet. Has not come yet. قُمْ فَاغْتَنِمِ الْفُرْصَةَ بَيْنَ الْعَدَمَيْنَ. So you have to stand up and take the opportunity between two kinds of nothingness. One nothing is past. The other nothing has not come yet. So what exists is present time. Currently we present. Currently we are living. So take the opportunity of right now, the moment that you live. If you take this opportunity, tomorrow, today will become past, and you control the past. And again, you can plan for your future, because tomorrow is the future of today, and tomorrow you will change your current day as well. Then the moment that you're living is very important. Do not think about your past, do not think about your future. But now, you can do whatever you want. You can change your past. You can plan for your future. Whatever you want, you can do right now. At the moment you live, at the moment you're hearing my voice. Don't postpone your change process. Don't delay your revolutionary process of your time, your life. Right now, you can change your time.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
The other things in the process of changing we have to focus is the different organs that we have. Especially some of them are important, like tongue, eyes, ears, heart, These are so important. We have to watch all of these things during the day. Whatever we talk is important. Before talking, please let me think about that. Whatever I am talking is important to hurting somebody or benefiting somebody. Which one is coming out of my mouth is important. Especially many sins that we have that are counted in the books of ethics are coming out of our tongue. We are backbiting, we are telling lies, we are breaking the heart of some people through our words and talking. So if you control your tongue, you can change the real world. You can change your heart. You can change your inner side. Eyes are important. Ears are important. I do remember one hadith from Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wassalam, the fourth Imam of Shiite Muslims. Imam says, the duration of this world, materialistic world, toward the hereafter, is like a sleep that you are having a dream in that sleep, but this dream is not so pleasant dream. You are fearing, you are annoying at that dream. This is like a dream with respect to the duration of life in Akhirah, in the hereafter. If it is so, then I can live it without any problems. Even if you are in a some jails, for example, or prison, in difficulties, entangled in the difficulties, you enjoy that situation because it is passing. It is foregoing. Then you have to forego many, many things. Forego means to deny, to go without seeing, without focusing in around. If there is a problem, do not fix on that problem. Forgo. If there is a problem, somebody said to you that is not so good thing, forgo. Because the time is forgoing. The time is going without staying, without reaching the point to stay. And if you forgo, you are flowing day by day, and this flowing gives you some flourishing, some refreshness. You can reach a fresh atmosphere of living if you practice that. So, the way we can change is inside, not outside. And if you change yourself, then you can become sure that the real world changing by Allah's power, by Allah's will. How could we change? Focusing on current time, the moment that you live. Forget about the past as well as the future. In the sense, do not stay in the past and do not live in the future. Forget in this month. But some people, unfortunately, live in the past. Some people live in the future. Rarely people you can find that living in the moment, in the present time. To change that, focus about your attitude toward this world, to transform whatever is bad at the first sight to the best one, and to focus on your organs, your eyes, tongue, ears, heart, and the other faculties that Allah gifted us. And these are as well dedicated to Lady Fatima Zahra, salamullah alayha. We can change the way of our life toward the other companions that they lived in this journey toward Allah the Almighty. If you accompany with the perfect people, they can take your hand toward Allah the Almighty in the best way, in an easiest way. But if you forget about them, you will become in trouble, in difficulty. Inshallah, I ask Allah the Almighty to put us among the people, travelers, wayfarers toward Allah the Almighty, who were perfect people, such as Ahlul Bayt, such as Lady Fatima Zahra, salamullah alayha, and the other prophets, previous prophets, and enable us to change the situation that we live to the best one, inshallah rahman. Wa akhiru da'wana alhamdulillah rabbil alameen. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Farshi turab yadumuni wa huwa ghita'i hawli ar-rimal taluffuni bal min wara'i wal lahdu yahki dhulmatan fiha ibtila'i كتابه أنسي لقائي أنسي لقائي والأهل أين حنانهم باعوا وفائي باعوا وفائي وفائي والصحب
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The number of forcibly displaced persons around the world has increased dramatically, reaching almost 80 million. According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, the number of refugees has also gone up from roughly 15 million a decade ago to 26 million today. And 77% of the refugees find themselves in a protracted situation, defined as having remained displaced without a durable solution, such as voluntary return to their home countries following the resolution of conflicts, resettlement, or local integration for more than 5 years. Because of persistent conflicts, only 3.9 million refugees were able to return to their homes between 2010 and 2019, compared to roughly 10 million between 2000 and 2010, and 15.3 million in the 1990s. Meanwhile, the European Union's new pact for migrants makes little allowance for how the COVID-19 pandemic is going to impact the EU's migration and asylum policies. The pandemic has profoundly affected the capacity of host countries to manage the presence of refugees and ensure their protection. Already fragile health infrastructures are stretched in helping local populations, let alone refugees. The pandemic has also eroded income from trade, tourism, and crucial revenue from remittances. The pact should recognize the dire forced migration picture, the impact of COVID-19, and the associated expected rise in poverty. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, M. Murat Erdogan, and Nihal Eminoglu. Titled, EU's New Pact on Migration and Asylum Missing a True Foundation. The article was published on brookings.edu website. Please stay with us for more. On 23rd of September, the European Commission launched a new Pact on Migration and Asylum, proposing to overhaul the European Union's long-ailing policies in this area. European Union Vice President Margaritis Schinas likened the pact to a building with three floors, comprised of an external dimension centered around strengthened partnerships with countries of origin and transit, robust management of external borders, and firm but fair internal rules. The Commission proposal must still make its way through the legislative process in the European Parliament and the European Council. The problem is, the pact needs a foundational basement, in the form of recognizing that an overwhelming majority of the world's refugees are hosted in developing countries. Without a basement, the whole edifice is undermined. The European Union must incorporate policy ideas from the Global Compact on Refugees, GCR, to rectify this. The pact's external dimension, which calls for strengthening partnership with countries of origin and transit in the EU's immediate neighborhood and beyond, is its ground floor. The second floor relates to policies to fortify and improve the management of the EU's external borders. The third floor proposes rules to resolve the long-standing challenge within the EU to achieve a more balanced distribution of responsibilities and promote solidarity among EU members in dealing with asylum seekers and refugees. At all three levels, the pact has faced intense pushback. With respect to the third floor, the Commission has been criticized for catering to the priorities of the more conservative and anti-immigrant member states such as Hungary, Poland, and Slovakia. The pact allows members to opt out from participating in the relocation of asylum seekers and refugees within the EU by offering them the possibility to instead provide administrative and financial support to other member states. Serious doubts have been expressed about the viability of this scheme. On the second floor, the big concern is that, once again, border security has been prioritized over access to asylum. While emphasizing the principle of non-refoulement as enshrined in international refugee law, the pact at the same time introduces measures that are clearly meant to complicate the possibility that individuals fleeing persecution and conflicts can seek to obtain protection in the European Union. A former director of the Centre for Refugee Studies at Oxford University sees these measures as aiming to harden and formalise the fortress Europe. Migrants and refugees were to be kept out of Europe at all costs. The emphasis on protecting Europe's borders becomes most evident at the ground floor. Here the pact calls the revamping partnership with third countries and reflects the European Union's long-standing policy of externalizing the cost and responsibility of managing its external borders. Tying policy issues such as development assistance, trade concessions, security, education, agriculture, and visa facilitation for third country nationals to those countries' willingness to cooperate on migration management has long been criticized as asymmetrical. The pact takes this relationship to a new coercive level by suggesting the possibility of applying restrictive visa measures to third countries unwilling to be cooperative. Time will tell whether these problems on each floor will be addressed as the Commission proposal makes its way through the legislative process. However, there is a deeper structural problem to the pact, resulting from the missing basement. This is because the pact fails to account for two major global realities confronting the European Union. The problem is that the pact is so inward-oriented that it fails to recognize the policy implications of the dire state of forced migration globally. The number of forcibly displaced persons has increased dramatically, reaching almost 80 million individuals. According to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, the number of refugees alone has gone up from roughly 15 million a decade ago to 26 million today. And 77% of the refugees find themselves in a protracted situation, defined as having remained displaced without a durable solution, such as voluntary return to their home countries following the resolution of conflicts, resettlement, or local integration for more than 5 years. Because of persistent conflicts, only 3.9 million refugees were able to return to their homes between 2010 and 2019, compared to roughly 10 million between 2000 and 2010, and 15.3 million in the 1990s. Secondly, the pact makes little allowance for how the COVID-19 pandemic is going to impact the European Union's migration and asylum policies. The pandemic has profoundly affected the capacity of host countries to manage the presence of refugees and ensure their protection. Already fragile health infrastructures are stretched in helping local populations, let alone refugees. The pandemic has also eroded income from trade, tourism, and crucial revenue from remittances. The pact should recognize the dire forced migration picture, the impact of COVID-19, and the associated expected rise in poverty. The Economist and the United Nations have noted that the pandemic risks undoing the gains made against poverty in the past 2 decades. According to the World Bank, most affected will be developing countries, but more than 85% of these refugees are hosted. Is likely to erode the capacity of these countries to cope with the presence of refugees and manage public resentment as competition for scarce resources between refugees and locals intensifies. Under these circumstances, it would not be unrealistic to expect pressures for secondary movements towards the EU to build up, reminiscent of the ones that occurred during 2015 and 2016. The European Union has an interest in recognizing the reality presented by the basement floor, and should supplement policies on the first floor and above accordingly. A former UNHCR official points out, the pact hardly makes any reference to the Global Compact on Refugees, GCR, but it could be a so-called inspiring source of policy ideas. The idea of the Global Compact on Refugees emerged from the September 2016 United Nations Summit in New York that was held to address the challenges resulting from the European migration crisis. Adopted in December of 2018, the Global Compact on Refugees recognizes that the traditional refugee protection system based on the 1951 Geneva Convention is under duress, if not broken. Against this reality, it calls on the international community to work together in the spirit of burden and responsibility sharing, to improve the self-reliance of refugees and the resilience of their host communities, as well as help hosts transform refugees from being a humanitarian burden to a development and economic opportunity. All European Union member countries, apart from Hungary, have endorsed the GCR, the Global Compact on Refugees. Though the pact fails to acknowledge the GCR, the Global Compact on Refugees, the European Union Vice President Margaritis Schinas promises to seek global solutions and responsibility sharing with international partners on migration, as well as proposes to establish a union resettlement and humanitarian admission framework regulation that would provide a stable EU framework for the European Union contribution to global resettlement efforts. These reflect at least the spirit of the GCR, the Global Compact on Refugees. However, the European Union needs to go beyond this and heed to the Global Compact on Refugees' call to promote economic opportunities, decent work, job creation and entrepreneurship programs for host community members and refugees in refugee hosting countries. Then can the European Union enjoy a solid basement floor for the rest of the pact. The Global Compact on Refugees offers a rich array of innovative policy suggestions that the European Union can take into consideration when negotiating partnerships with countries hosting large numbers of refugees. One such policy idea calls for a more active involvement of the private sector in supporting self-reliance of refugees through decent and sustainable employment. In its partnership agreement, the European Union could include terms incentivizing companies to offer such opportunities for refugees. This could be enabled by extending preferential trade arrangements for countries hosting large numbers of refugees, which is something the Global Compact on Refugees mentions. Such partnerships with the European Union could be conditioned to refugees being offered sustainable employment opportunities. The advantage of all this is that the resulting economic growth would also benefit host communities, support social cohesion, and help empower already fragile economies coming out of the COVID-19-induced economic recession. It would also give the partnerships that the European Union is advocating for at the ground floor of the pact a much more solid foundation based on a cooperative spirit rather than the current formulation. In this way, the new pact would help create a win-win-win outcome, benefiting refugees, benefiting the host countries, and benefiting the EU.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.